Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Cornelius Vanderbilt was born when George Washington still lived long enough to do business with John D. Rockefeller, and in between built a fortune that, by his death in 1877, accounted for one out of every $20 in this country. He was America's first tycoon, built steamships and railroads and Grand Central Terminal, built, says a new biography, a style of finance that still drives the American economy today, that may have helped drive it into crisis. This hour On Point, Cornelius Vanderbilt and the Way of the Tycoon. And lest you think this is all just ancient history, think again even biologically. Cornelius Vanderbilt, great tycoon, his four greats grandson, is CNN's Anderson Cooper, Gloria Vanderbilt's boy, you know. Joining me now from San Francisco is historian T.J. Stiles. In 2003, Stiles published Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War. He's just spent 7 years researching and writing his terrific new biography, The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. T.J. Stiles, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be on the show.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. His latest book takes on plenty of 19th century business. It is Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. Jack, welcome to the 21st century. It's fun to look back with you at the 19th.
It is indeed. Hello, Tom, and hello to you, Mr. Stiles.
It's nice to be in the show with you.
T.J. Stiles, this is a big and it is a terrific biography. I had no idea, but it really sucks us into another time and place. But, of course, you know, we've got 700 pages under our belt, and a lot of our listeners would not. I think it'd be great if you just start out kind of painting a picture. We have these names that come down, robber barons, great industrial magnates, you know, Rockefeller and Carnegie and Vanderbilt. Where does he stand in that kind of pantheon? What sets him apart? Give us the kind of thumbnail understanding. We'll dig into the details.
Well, one of the things about Vanderbilt is, to start off, is just that it's hard to think of another figure in the history of American business who had a more personally dramatic life. And I certainly hope that carries the reader along for 700 pages because his life was personally adventurous as well as consequential. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing, of course, is that it was so consequential. During his lifetime, the United States went from a coastal strip of settlements along the Atlantic, the post-colonial society. He ran a little open sailboat between Manhattan and Staten Island.
Where his family had a farm, no fortune there.
That's right. His parents were not wealthy. They didn't belong to the old Knickerbocker aristocracy that reigned in New York. Mm. They were poor, striving people. And he was very lucky. He was born across the bay from New York City, which was rapidly rising in the 19th century. And he gradually expanded his business career in keeping with the American economy and American geography, too. His core business was always transportation, and transportation in the 19th century was by far the most important sector of the economy. And when he finally got into railroads at the end of his life, railroads were vastly larger than any other kind of company. Individual railroads sometimes were larger than entire industries.
And he had a ton of them, a dozen railroads he owned.
Yeah, that's right. And he progressed to that final stage of his career by following the main channel of commerce in the American economy. And wherever kind of the primary route of trade was, he would seize upon it and become the dominant player in that route. So, you know, it goes from early New York to Philadelphia to New York, to industrial New England before the Civil War, the California Gold Rush. He moves into California steamship traffic. And then finally, after the Civil War, with the rise of the Midwest and northern industry, he built a system between Chicago and New York. So his ability to focus his business career on where the American economy was growing means that his personal story really tells us a lot about the making of modern America.
And, of course, steam very important to him itself. I mean, he dominated steam between New York and Boston, a big line. And then, as you say,
up and down the coast all the way to California. He thought about his own passage across Nicaragua. I mean, as I read you, he's kind of out there, you know, trying to force the steamboat up the river Nicaragua and hack through the jungle to get Gold Rush folks around the bend.
Yeah, this is not John D. Rockefeller or Andrew Carnegie. This is someone who was an athlete, you know, self-educated. I shouldn't even say uneducated. He was self-educated because he was one of the, in the paddle wheel era, he went from paddle wheel steamboats to paddle wheel, side wheel steamships. He was one of the great maritime architects of that era, and he personally designed and supervised the construction of all of his vessels when he was in shipping. And he was this very, a man who was always, you know, in the forefront, physically in the forefront of what his businesses were doing. So as you mentioned, when he went to, started a transit route across Nicaragua during the Gold Rush that connected to his steamships, you know, this was a very remote, undeveloped rainforest country. And he personally took his steamboat, riverboat up through the rapids in a kind of African Queen scenario, rode his horse through the wilds to mark out a carriage road, got involved in fist fights, survived train wrecks and steamboat explosions, and into his 80s was racing his fast trotting horses in Upper Manhattan.
It's a very muscular path to fortune, and give us a sense of the scale of that fortune. I was trying to take on board what it would mean to have assets equivalent to one in every $20 in the whole country. I just can't even picture that.
Well, let's compare. I mean, there's one thing I don't do. I mean, a lot of historians do that I don't, and that's to give modern equivalent figures. Personally, I just think the 19th century economy was so different. It was not fully integrated. The markets are not fully integrated. The economy was uneven compared to our economy now. So just multiplying it by an inflation figure, I don't think tells you anything.
So how do you scale it? How do we sense it?
That's exactly what the number you gave before is how I try to give some sense of it, which is comparing it to the money stock, what the controller of the currency measured as being the amount of dollars in circulation. And his fortune at his death, $100 million, which is not chump change today, in 1877 was equal to one out of every $9 in cash, or out of every $20 if you include bank deposits.
I mean, the Federal Reserve Bank doesn't have that kind of standing.
Well, I'm not sure I would put it that way, but let's compare it to Bill Gates. Before, in September last year, before the crash, his fortune was estimated at, I think it's 53 or 58 billion. Mm-hmm. And if you compare that to the Fed's M2 figure, which is sort of very roughly
money supply.
The measure of the money supply, including bank deposits, a lot of other stuff. He had one out of every $138. Now, of course, he doesn't have that. That's the, you know, if we compare the value of his estate to the
amount
of money.
Right, but still, it makes it clear. A cropper compared to Cornelius Vanderbilt, and that's Bill Gates. Jack Beatty, when you look back on this guy, the Commodore, he self-styled himself, and it stuck. What do you see from the outset, Jack?
Well, as Mr. Stiles vividly brings out, Vanderbilt incarnates the heroic virtues of competition, which is really the moral gravity in the universe of capitalism. As you say, he bears the military title. He's Commodore Vanderbilt. And he really stands out in this heroic aspect from the pantheon of his peers. Consider Rockefeller and Carnegie. Rockefeller said that only a professor could believe in the Adam Smith world of atomistic price competition. It nearly ruined the refinery industry in Cleveland before he brought it to order by monopoly. Andrew Carnegie, he timed his entry into the steel business in Pittsburgh when competition was dormant in the Depression of the early 70s. The real time to extend your operations, he said, is when nobody else was doing it. Carnegie went on to construct his empire in steel behind tariff walls protecting him from foreign competition. Now, with Vanderbilt, by contrast, he relished competition. Against its moral whetstone, he really sharpened and keened his character. His enterprises lost their zest for him when the struggle was over and he had won. He was a two-fisted, get out of my way or I'll run over you, or maybe I'll run over you anyway, capitalist. Deploring his excesses, you know, even contemporaries admired his contemporary critics admired his force. He was the fiercest beast in the Darwinian jungle of mid-19th century capitalism. And I think Tennyson's line fits him to a T. Dragons of the prime who tore each other in the slime were mellow music matched with him.
Wow. Fiercest beast in the Darwinian jungle. We're going to get into that jungle. T.J. Stiles, hero, beast, villain. There was a lot of invective poured on him. On the other hand, you had to respect a man who owned and built that much of the country.
Well, that's exactly it. That, you know, he was a very tough guy. He was a hard man. And yet, there's a difference between being a hard man and a tough man and a fighter and being nasty or a cheater. And it's telling that a lot of his foes, when he was in the heat of battle, he would do anything that he could to beat his opponents. And yet, when the battle was over, he it was all business. It was nothing personal. And some of his fiercest business opponents became his card-playing partners in Saratoga Springs after the battle was over. So he was somebody who really was respected and admired. He was never considered a nice or sweet man, but he was somebody that people genuinely liked, in the way that people like tough but completely competent and people have really earned their pride in themselves. Mm-hmm. But you know, I wanted to say something about just in response to that. I totally agree with what Jack was saying.
TJ, would you hold the thought, because we have to take a short break here. We want to get your thought in its fullness. We're going to take a short break right here. TJ Stiles is with us. His new biography is The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. He fought over the Erie Canal. We'll hear about that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
15 years on the Erie Canal. Get up there, gal, we've passed that lock. We'll make room for 6 o'clock. So one more trip and then we'll go right back home to Buffalo.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. T.J. Stiles joins us from San Francisco. Jack Beatty's with us as well, author most recently of Age of Betrayal. He knows this century and its business. And, T.J., we're getting traffic on the website. Here's a comment. It kind of has a question for you. I mean, here's an attitude that maybe is good to put some of Vanderbilt's history against. It says, this is from BHA, "Vanderbilt, like all other personal capitalists, stretched any available law to his personal financial gain. Due to their greed and immoral actions, we have laws against monopolies. The as long as I get mine attitude is what drove the world economy into the toilet, started by the collapse of subprime mortgages, exacerbated by the greed of those packaging them as investments such that they could not be traced." There's a lot there. Some of it speaks to your themes, TJ. What do you say?
What I would like to say is that I certainly don't. When Jack was talking before about how Vanderbilt exemplifies the heroic era of American capitalism, I totally agree. But we have to make sure that people understand. We don't mean necessarily that he was a hero in kind of the colloquial sense. We mean heroic in terms of this very dramatic, combative figure taking, you know, violent action, so to speak.
Standing above the rest for good or ill.
Exactly. And what I try to do is, rather than, you know, either raising him up as a hero or tearing him down, as a lot of accounts have in the past, is look at him in his full light and look at how Americans at the time focused on him. And he was a very contradictory figure, and he was a very controversial figure. You know, early in life, he was attacked by a lot of the wealthier elite who thought that competition was destructive, that we had a young economy, and that if you compete, you're going to destroy capital and we're not going to develop the country.
And it messed with their social order. Here was this farm kid from Staten Island sort of busting in with all this money into their parlors.
Yeah, precisely. That these dramatic business battles he was in were more than personal matters. They were part of the creation of an individualistic, commercial, competitive society in America, much more like the one we know today. On the other hand, late in life, he constructed some of the first giant corporations in American history. And that's where I would just add something to what Jack was saying before. As his businesses, as he got involved in railroads, and as his businesses became vast, he went through two interestingly parallel transformations. Personally, he became a more agreeable fellow. He was actually welcomed late in life into the social elite of New York's old gentry. And his relations with his family grew warmer. They're always troubled, but they grew warmer. But in a business sense, he becomes more ambivalent at the end of his life, because he became a man who actually took part in cartels. Railroads would compete against each other, but when one, if it lost and went bankrupt, it was still there, running alongside of you. Railroads didn't move. And so railroad chieftains were always looking for accommodation. And Vanderbilt was always ready to compete and fight whenever anybody challenged him. But at the end of his life, he actually sought accommodation rather than seeking battles he did earlier in life. Mm-hmm. So that sort of also follows. That's another part of the world we're living with today, that large corporation that's would prefer not to have to compete against the up-and-comers.
We'll look at some of what he authored there. You end up calling him by his life's end, in a way, the self-made chief executive of a country that he himself had invented, rather like a cross between George Washington and Genghis Khan. Let's get a call from Laura in Salt Lake City. Laura, you're on the air with TJ Styles and Jack Beatty.
Hi. This is actually sounding like two books that I actually want to read, but I was wondering if you could define what robber baron is. I have not heard that term before, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Oh, that's a great thing to poke at, because there's a story here, TJ. You write that he inspired the phrase, the term robber baron. Maybe it fits, maybe it doesn't. But Laura asks, first of all, what did it mean?
Well, today, pardon me, today we would say that a robber baron was somebody, much like, again, what Jack was saying about Rockefeller or Carnegie, somebody who used their market power to crush competitors and keep them from rising up. Rockefeller was famous for his involvement in the South Improvement Company, in which he got the railroads to actually give him kickbacks for the shipment of oil from his competitors, because he occupied so much of the market that he could demand extraordinary concessions from the railroads. That's what we think of as a robber baron today. Now, the term actually originated in 1859 when the New York Times attacked Vanderbilt. But they didn't attack him for being a monopolist. They attacked him for competing against monopolies. And this is the origins of the term goes back to, again, this early pre-Civil War thinking about the American economy, when there were certain members, mostly of the Whig Party, not all, but some Whigs, who really thought competition was bad, and that in our economy, the government should help set up corporations to carry out big public projects. And if you competed against them, you were hurting the public good. And what Vanderbilt did was he would compete, and sometimes he would accept a payment to go away and leave the market. And so the editor of the New York Times compared him to the German robber barons on the Rhine, who took a toll on all passing traffic. If you were running on the monopoly line that was paying off Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt was taking part of your money. So, that itself is kind of an ambivalent practice. We're not sure whether we like that or not. But the point is that robber baron was a term invented to condemn a guy for being too competitive. And it became changed to the guy who was too monopolistic.
Jack, I've heard you speak of those German robber barons throwing their chain across the Rhine and taking their piece of flesh out of anybody who came by. It's pretty much straight up pejorative now. But how do you see Vanderbilt in robber baron terms? The greatest, the least, the worst, the best?
Well, I think this idea of tithing, of essentially shaking down companies that are in business and saying to them, look, I'll go into business against you, and the only way you can prevent that is to pay me a fee, that looks like a robber baron. But, of course, the company he was doing this against in the instant case was the Pacific Mail, which was really what Mr. Stiles talks about, a franchise corporation, a company with a government monopoly to run the mail from New York to California.
This was pre-railroad?
Yeah.
Was it steamship mail or Pony Express?
That's right, yeah. And so he was, he was holding up a monopoly. It's hard to sort of see that as a robber baron. On the other hand, it's hard to see it as Robin Hood. But I think that in the debate over this robber baron thing, the point that gets lost, and it's a good one that Mr. Stiles brings out, is the one that Harper's brought out in this controversy about robber baron. They said, whatever he does, his competition or his threat of competition brings, quote, a permanent reduction in fares. This great boon, cheap travel, the community owes mainly to Cornelius Vanderbilt. And I think this was the upshot of his enterprises. Fares went down. Similarly, you know, with John D. Rockefeller, every year the price of kerosene and then of oil went down, down, down. He was smart enough to realize that if he held up the entire economy with his 90% monopoly, he'd be prosecuted, as he ultimately was. But he also made sure that the returns of productivity went to the consumer in lower fares.
So good if it works. I wanted to ask you about transportation. I mean, he made his fortune in steamboats and rail and steamboat packets to California. Today we think of transportation as an awfully low-margin business. Airlines struggle. Railways need government subsidies. Why was transportation so lucrative in 19th century America? And then we heard a little bit of that Erie Canal song. I wish you could take us into the battle over that particular venue of transportation.
Well, we have to think about the 19th century. Today, how many options do we have to get around? And how relatively inexpensive, even with higher price of oil these days, is it to get around? I mean, you can drive, you can take public transportation of all kinds. There are still passenger trains in this country, especially in the Northeast. Of course, you can fly. And when it comes to freight, there's barges and there's trains and there's airline transportation and trucks. There's so many different ways in which you can travel that there's constant competition among all these different modes. And we have such a thoroughly developed system. It's a mature system. So the profit margins, it's not growing. The profit margins are shrinking. In the 19th century, you had very few options for getting around. You had sailboats and horses and wagons. And, you know, canals.
And when he was born, those were the way.
That was the only way. And he started off sailing a boat himself, carrying out rescues of ships in New York Harbor in the middle of storms in his little sailboat. Gradually the technology changed. First they added in canals, which you can talk about, and then the steamboat, which was a revolutionary transformation. It seems so antiquated now, but the idea of being able to go in any direction you want to on the water, regardless of the wind or tide or current, was just a revolution. And then railroads, which allowed you to carry such huge amounts of goods over long distances, overland. These were, when each one appeared, the field was wide open. And each one had a vast improvement over the previous level of technology. And Americans were gradually spreading across the continent. You know, like I said, when he started, most Americans lived within a day's ride of the Atlantic coast. And when he died, the United States was a continental empire. Even Alaska was a part of the United States territory at that point. And So this geographical expansion was matched by this technological development, and he was riding the technological wave, and it was constantly growing.
And everybody battling for a piece of it. Then there's the Erie Railroad battle with James Fisk and Jay Gould, big figures. The Erie War, 1867-68. Tell us about that.
Well, this was a case that, for people who are interested in the history of American business from the 19th century, it's a very, very famous, or I should say notorious case, because it seemed to capture, it was extremely dramatic, kind of jaw-dropping even to this day, and it seemed to capture everything that Americans thought was wrong with post-Civil War America.
What happened?
Well, the Erie Railway was one of the four major railroads, they called them the trunk lines, that connected the Atlantic coast to the west. Mm-hmm. And the Erie Railway was always one that was constantly in trouble, always being mismanaged. And one of the leading figures in it was a friend of Vanderbilt's, Daniel Drew, who used his position as treasurer to short sell his own railway stock.
Okay.
So, driving down the share price of his own company made him very popular.
Yeah, not.
Anyway, in 1867, Vanderbilt was just in the process of taking over one of the other four major trunk lines, the New York Central. And he got embroiled in a fight with Drew that had to do with the stock market and the credit markets at the time. Drew was engaging in these short-selling operations that actually lowered prices all across the board on Wall Street and hurt Vanderbilt's takeover of this unrelated railroad. And so he decided that he was going to corner the market in Erie shares and punish Drew by driving up the price so that Drew would lose money in his short sales. Okay, this personal battle starts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, new management had come in alongside of Drew, and they included two young men named Jay Gould and Jim Fisk. Jay Gould, you know, slender, bearded, kind of brooding, silent figure, and Jim Fisk was became his friend and partner, brash, flamboyant, somebody who declaimed constantly to the press and was very funny. They were the odd couple of American business, but they were very effective. And they, alongside of Drew, began to simply, you know, print stock certificates. And, you know, there were complicated means by which they justified it. But they just manufactured new stock so that Vanderbilt was buying and buying, and they were just constantly producing new stock in their railway. And so Vanderbilt got a judge, a notoriously corrupt judge, to issue arrest warrants. So the officers of the Erie Railway, one of the three or four largest corporations in America, you know, had to scamper aboard a ferry and escape to New Jersey to avoid arrest, carrying bales of stock certificates and greenbacks with them.
Sounds kind of like Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns, if you add in a SWAT team and a helicopter flight off the roof of Bear Stearns, I mean, it was just astounding. I mean, you can imagine the AIG executives, you know, the fleeing to Mexico. That would be the equivalent.
Right.
So then Jay Gould, the New York State legislature, started to investigate because this stock increase, it was called stock watering at the time, mm-hmm. was illegal. And so they were considering, you know, either a motion to condemn the Erie people or a bill to legalize their shares issue. And a member of the New York State legislature went to see the Erie railway man in New Jersey and said, you know, I think we could be persuaded if you come equipped the right way. Jay Gould went to Albany with a suitcase full, literally with a suitcase full of cash, and bought off the New York State legislature. When an officer of the court came to arrest him because he was back in New York State, he said, well, you know, you can go with me and I'll still be in your custody. And the man seems to have been amply rewarded for his consideration. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of Jay Gould's efforts, the stock shares were legalized, these new shares, and Vanderbilt lost, except he didn't lose. He kept his lawsuits going. The judge kept the arrest warrants out. And he used that pressure to force the Erie Railway to pay him back. So he admitted he was you know, not going to have any control of the railway, but he actually got most of his losses back from the Erie Railway. But it created a sort of a match set of enemies, Vanderbilt and Gould and Fisk, and they really hated each other, and their battles sort of dominated Wall Street for the next several years.
Jack, we've just got 30 seconds before the break here, but you can hear T.J. Stiles taking us from the time when business was kind of immediate, family, and visceral, up into this realm where American business and capitalism become very much creatures of high finance. And working the market, working the finance, working the authorities becomes central to big business.
Yes, bears and bulls and watering of stock and all of it unregulated. That may be the connection with our current crisis. Mm. The abstract economy then was completely unregulated. And the result was periodic panics and wreckage of the whole country. Well, what have we had now? We've had unregulated speculation on Wall Street. What has it brought about? Panic, pretty much depression for the recession for the whole country. So nothing has changed in that respect, I don't think.
T.J. Stiles, Jack Beatty, please stand by. The new biography is The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, a name that for a long, long time meant big money. Here, 1948, Judy Garland and Fred Astaire, the Vanderbilt still in song. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The Vanderbilts have asked us up for tea.
We don't know how to get there. No, siree.
No, siree. We would drive up the avenue, but we haven't got the price.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the first American tycoon, Cornelius Vanderbilt, and the American economy he helped create. Victor in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Victor, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is this. We're trying to evaluate this man's life and what it meant, but it seems kind of abstract and academic and even borderline elitist that we haven't yet mentioned the people that kind of built his empire, you know, the workers. And I guess my question is, how did he treat those people? Was he just another one of those people who squeezed wages? Was there any hint of generosity or altruism? And, I mean, that seems to me much more relevant to what we're going through right now than, you know, whether he was, a buccaneer or whatever of the economy.
Of course, those workers may get squeezed by some of the abstract part of the interaction of finance and business, too. Mm-hmm. But it's a very good and direct question. And what do you say, TJ?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, because that's one of the ways in which Vanderbilt represents, one of the more troubling aspects of 19th century capitalism, that when it came to his battles against other men who wanted to build businessmen who wanted to build monopolies and cut down competition, he appears in the positive role, the sort of admirable role for most people. But he did squeeze his workers. When he was running steamboats in New York waters, I found newspaper, or rather magazine accounts, complaining that on Vanderbilt steamboats, everybody was expected to tip for everything, because he was cutting back on what his workers
because
on the
they needed
were
it
earning.
To live.
Mm-hmm. They needed it to live, and tipping came about because they were being squeezed for their wages. When he took his in 1853, he went on this grand tour of Europe in a private yacht with his family that was the size of an ocean liner, and he later turned it into an ocean liner called the North Star. Well, on the day that he was going to set sail, there was a lot of labor strife in New York, and the firemen, the guys who stoked the fires into the boilers, and some of the sailors went on strike. So what did he do? He fired them on the spot and hired untrained men and brought them on board and set sail the same day. And, you know, he had problems as a result. There is a story that one of the new sailors was told to strike two bells, and he came back and he said, "Please, sir, I can only find one." And so... On
that's
the other
funny,
hand,
but not funny. All those guys on strike were off the boat, fired out of a job.
It's true. And in a larger sense, also, what we see in Vanderbilt's life is a transformation of America from a more flat society in which there were not many large enterprises, none that we would today consider large enterprises, before the Civil War, when, you know, most Americans thought that working for wages was a temporary condition. And eventually you'd get a farm or open your own shop or start a small business and
be your own boss.
Your own boss. Exactly. That was what this kind of the natural end that everybody expected for themselves. And what we see in his lifetime is the emergence of, a working class and the emergence of a middle class, too, where instead of people going off to work for themselves, they found work with these new large enterprises that were beginning to dominate the economy. And Vanderbilt led that transformation.
Standing up at the top in full naval uniform, the Commodore, even though he wasn't in the Navy.
No. He never wore naval uniform, but it was Commodore was the highest rank in the U.S. Navy before the Civil War, and it was a nickname given to him. They actually gave it to other steamboatmen, but it stuck to him.
Mm.
You know, Tom, about this Victor's point on labor relations, the New York Central, owned by Vanderbilt, was the scene of some of the most violent affrays in the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. And that was brought on when the railroads consorted all together to effectively cut wages for workers who are already earning 50 cents a day. 50 cents a day, called by the Ohio Bureau of Labor Standards, not enough to feed a family. And over 100 people were killed in these strikes, nearly all workers. And Vanderbilt's line saw Hornellsville and several other places saw some of the worst violence in that.
T.J. Stiles, what do we know about how he thought about that? Did he care? Did he think this is a democracy and things need to be shared around, or not at all?
Well, you know, I've never found anything that he said or wrote specifically about labor relations. But I would say that, and in late in life, it was his son William, actually, who managed, things like, work contracts and labor relations. His son did make the first deal with a union on the New York Central Railroad with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. So, they pursued their own interests, and sometimes that meant dealing with unions. Vanderbilt himself, though, seems to have really believed in the up-from-the-bootstraps philosophy. And I don't see any sign that he ever acknowledged that the America that he started in, like I said, a much flatter economy, he had helped change so that you know, becoming someone like Vanderbilt was never easy in the first place, and it had become much harder in this new corporate economy that was dominated by these large enterprises. I think he always thought everybody has a chance to do what I did. And you see that even in his own family. You know, he brought into his businesses sons, and his oldest son and his sons-in-law were often his right-hand men. But, you know, he didn't leave them much money in his will, except for his oldest son, because he wanted to start a dynasty. These sons-in-law, who served him faithfully for years, he expected them to make their own fortunes along the way. So even within his own family, you know, he expected people to lift themselves up.
Boys, be ambitious. Let's go to Peter in Andover, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Well, yes, hi. I'd just like to weigh in on the importance of people like Cornelius Vanderbilt, Henry Burden, and others who really did a great job of bringing the United States into the forefront of industrialism. And frankly, I think they take a bad rap as so-called robber barons, because, you know, I can always recall my father telling me that a poor man never created a job. And so I think we ought to pay due homage to people the likes of Cornelius Vanderbilt for contributing the way they did to the culture and the success of this country as we know it.
Peter, thanks very much for your call. T.J. Stiles, how do you look at that? I mean, I remember growing up in my elementary school library, there were plenty of books sort of, you know, just glorifying the great industrialists of the 19th century. There were big biographies, children's biographies of, you know, Carnegie and all the rest there. I don't remember if Vanderbilt was there. But Americans both complained about and worshipped these people for a long time in many ways. Peter goes for the applause line. Where does your balance come down?
Well, balance is exactly what I try to strike. I mean, you know, we've seen swings in kind of the center of gravity and opinion by writers about this era. And, you know, the book, The Robber Barons by Matthew...
Josephson.
Josephson, exactly. Thank you. You know, sort of established that model. And then we've had books, especially over the last 20 years, you know, some of which are just simply... you know, fair, honest biographies, excellent ones by Mari Klein and Gene Strauss, for example. But, you know, we've also seen some books that have been raising up these guys and praising them in contrast to the earlier generations condemning of them. Now, what I try to do is I really try to look at them in their own terms, look at Vanderbilt in his own terms, and focus on not my condemnation or praise for him, but what people at the time saw, and to bring out what he did. And I think it is a very valid point that I do emphasize, that this is a man who had vision, who created great wealth, who he integrated the transportation network of the United States, reduced costs dramatically, helped to really bring the country together, literally bring it together, and created vast wealth as a result. Now, you know, I also try to make clear that in pursuing his private interests, he sometimes hurt the public interest. But rather than condemning him and saying, therefore, he was a villain, I make the point that, you know, this is a conundrum that we have in a capitalist system where, you know, private enterprise creates wealth and it creates businesses that we all benefit from and has given us an affluent society. On the other hand, in pursuing their private interests, businessmen can affect the public good in vast ways, as we've seen recently with some of the terrible decisions that have been made on Wall Street. Now, Vanderbilt, you know, I give him full credit for being not only extremely effective, but also extremely honest. You know, Andrew Carnegie learned from the ways of the Pennsylvania Railroad, one of Vanderbilt's rivals, and he built his fortune with inside deals and sweetheart deals you know, he didn't just simply lift himself up by his bootstraps, but Vanderbilt did, and he was always very honest in his management. But he did carry out acts. At one point, he cut off all rail traffic into New York from the West. He cut off the city, basically, for a few days to settle a business dispute. Now, that's a problem. So I try to be honest about both sides of the issue.
What do you make of, I mean, you're right, he was a hard man. His children thought the same, imperious. Not a lot of friends by the end. And you quote his one-time friend, John Morrissey, if I've got this right, later declaring after his death, I guess, "I have known in the course of my life burglars, fighting men, and loafers, but never have I known such a bad fellow as Commodore Vanderbilt." Sour grapes? Did he cut him off from some fortune? What happened there?
Yeah, Morrissey also said he died without leaving a debt or a friend.
Ouch. But
you know, Morrissey was, as I point out, it's not true that Vanderbilt died without friends. He actually had a lot of friends. You know, when I looked at, for example, his second wife's letters after their marriage in 1869, you know, they were just besieged. They went to Saratoga Springs afterwards, and they were besieged by Vanderbilt's friends. You know, clearly he had, you know, he was a social man who had a lot of friends. But what we see is the people who admired him and befriended him were businessmen who dealt with him in those substantive, creative ways of managing businesses, even competing against him, but then respecting him in the process. Morrissey was a man who was a prize fighter, a politician, a Tammany Hall operative, who ran a gambling saloon and was constantly trying to get rich in the stock market.
Okay.
And he felt, and he was trying to get rich off his friendship with Vanderbilt, and eventually, you know, that failed.
Yeah.
And most of the people who were most critical of Vanderbilt, who knew him personally, were the ones who just wanted to get rich quick off of their association with him and failed. So, you know, it's an important distinction to make.
Jack, so here, on the one hand, there's this heroic builder up by the bootstrap story. On the other hand, Jack, your very book is named Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America. Do you put Vanderbilt in some kind of betrayal column, or is it maybe obviously not that simple?
Well, a corruption column, perhaps. You know, in his diary in 1888, Rutherford B. Hayes writes, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. No longer we were a government of the corporations, for the corporations, and by the corporations." What did he mean? He meant the railway corporations. He meant the substantial corruption of government by railroads, which was part of the way railroads grew. We just heard about Jay Gould rushing up to Albany with a suitcase full of cash to buy out the government. And as early as the 60s, Charles Francis Adams was warning about what he called a power within a power, a state within a state, that corporations would grow so vast and powerful that they would overawe and overpower democratic government, and that corruption would work great harm to the system. And I think there's no question that we call the age the Gilded Age, partly because of that corruption.
TJ, you have Vanderbilt, on the one hand, putting his own steamboat at the service of the Union Army in the Civil War to keep ironclad Confederate warboat, you know, at bay. On the other hand, I don't know how you judge this, but you say he was so important in creating this sort of abstraction of economic reality as the connection faded between the tangible world and the new devices of business, paper currency, corporations, securities. He helped create that side of the American economy that we've been wrestling so hard with lately.
Right, and there too we see the good and the bad. I was at a picnic a year or so ago with some friends who were math PhDs from Berkeley. And they were working for firms that design mathematical models to help hedge funds trade in the securities markets. And, you know, I started talking about how in the 19th century, you know, Americans really didn't understand the connection between securities and the underlying tangible world that they had all inhabited, of actual people and goods and buildings and things. And these guys, these math PhDs, looked at me and they said, "We have no idea what we do, how what we do connects to the real economy." And we see the origins of this issue that we're struggling with right now, and we have an echo of it as well, where, you know, in the current financial crisis, you know, there's some problems. How do we value securities? How do we know what they're really worth? How do they connect to underlying real, the real economy that underlies the financial markets? And in Vanderbilt's lifetime, this, you know, this all hit us by surprise recently because no one was paying attention. In Vanderbilt's lifetime, it was the center of political battles. And, you know, we talked about the Erie Railway with its stock watering. Well, you know, Vanderbilt also vastly increased the stock of his railways. But what he did is he created a stock split where he said, you know, if you have a share, you get another share. So that was, you know, today we would say, well, that's fair. But what the Erie guys did was unfair because they diluted everybody's stake in the company. But at the time, Vanderbilt got just as much abuse because people expected a share of stock to represent $100 worth of physical stuff and what it originally cost, not even its book value, you know, its later market value. And so people really insisted on a connection between the intangible security that sort of floats above the underlying real tangible world. And people really tried to keep them connected. And Vanderbilt, you know, he was not a philosopher, but he certainly grasped that, you know, the financial world is really about perceptions and about what we imagine. And that's both has potential for great creativity and wealth creation, and also, as we've seen, it has a potential for great disasters as well.
Speaking of perceptions, is it just me or in his portrait here I'm looking at, can I see Anderson Cooper's nose, the fourth great grandson? I think I see it there. He left a university, mansions on the beach, and a lot more, and a legacy that you've laid out really splendidly in this biography. T.J. Steele's new book is The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. Wonderful work, historian Stiles. Well done. It's really an interesting story, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot. I've enjoyed it.
Jack, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.